You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and it's Friday. So, of course, it is Brunch with Bernie, our national town hall meeting with the guy I think of as America's senator. Vermonters know that he is theirs, but he shares himself with us every Friday, and it's just great to have a national town hall meeting with the United States senator who will take your calls on pretty much any topic it is. Senator Sanders, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Tom.
And it's always so great to have you. What's going on in the Senate right now? What's at the top of your to-do list?
I'm on five committees, and one of the committees I'm on is the Budget Committee. And as I think listeners can guess, the Budget Committee has been working overtime lately. In fact, I think we have about five separate meetings this week. As an independent, I caucus with the Democrats, and I've been meeting with the Democrats who are majority on the caucus on the Budget Committee. And let me take a minute to tell you about what we're trying to work on and what's going on, because I think, you know, fiscal cliffs and continuing resolutions and all types of other fiscal issues can sometimes get a little bit crazy out there. So let me just try to touch upon where we are at. The president and I think most people recognize that the deficit is a serious situation. The deficit, by the way, has gone down. We're at about $850 billion this year. It's a lot. It's less than it used to be. Our national debt accumulation of deficits is over $16 trillion, a lot of money. First point to be made when we talk about the deficit is how we got into the deficit. Now, I think many listeners know that has everything in the world to do with Bush taking us into two wars and not paying for it, huge tax breaks for the wealthiest people in this country, and most importantly, I think, the Wall Street-caused recession, which resulted in massive unemployment. When people are unemployed, they're not paying their federal taxes. Businesses are going under. And the end result of all of that, and this is a point, Tom, that is not made often enough. One of the major causes of the deficit right now is that revenue, the amount of money coming into the federal government as a percentage of the economy, the gross domestic product, is at 15.8%. That is the lowest that it has been in 60 years. So when people like Mitch McConnell and other Republicans say, well, the only thing we can do to deal with the deficit is to cut Social Security, cut Medicare, cut Medicaid, cut, they're wrong. Because the amount of revenue coming in is at the lowest point that has been as a percentage of GDP in 60 years. So we have to make sure that we're not spending more than we should, but we also have to increase the amount of revenue that we bring in. And what the Republicans have been saying is, as I think, you know, people have heard John Boehner and Mitch McConnell and other Republican leaders say, no more revenue. We don't want any more. And they say that at a time when the wealthiest people in this country are doing phenomenally well. Let me give you one statistic, which I think should just knock the socks off of everybody who's listening. Recent study came out looking at income from 2009 to 2011. That's the last statistics that we have seen. Over 100% of all of the new income generated, Tom, went to the top 1%.
Over 1%. Over 100% means that somebody lost.
The bottom 99% saw a decline in their income.
Right.
So all of, when people talk about economic growth and everything else, what they should understand, all of the new income generated in America went to the top 1%. Meanwhile, what we are looking at is real unemployment. There were some unemployment statistics today, which were good. A couple of 100,000 jobs being created. That is good. But the fact is, real unemployment is not the 7.7% the papers are screaming about today. Real unemployment is over 14% if you include those people who have given up looking for work and people who are working part-time when they want to work full-time. Millions of people are out there who are working. They're working 20 hours a week. They want to work full-time. You have employers now who have cut back on work hours. They don't work, employ people 40 hours a week because they have to pay benefits. They do 30 hours a week. And all of that together, you are at over 14%. Those numbers are higher for young people. They're higher for people of color. All right. So what you have is wealthiest people doing phenomenally well. If you look at the stock market, you look at corporate profits are also, in many cases, at record-breaking levels. Corporations are doing phenomenally well. And here is the kicker. The effective tax rate that corporations are paying today is about 12% of profits, which is the lowest that it has been since 1972. You have one out of four major corporations in America paying nothing in taxes. Let me give you some examples of what I mean by that. In 2010, Bank of America set up more than 200 subsidiaries in the Cayman Islands. They did that not because they liked the climate in the Cayman Islands, which is no doubt very sunny and nice, but it's how you avoid paying U.S. taxes, and it worked. So in 2010, not only did the Bank of America not pay anything, not pay a nickel in federal income taxes, it received a rebate from the IRS worth $1.9 billion that year. Citigroup, you know, one of the large financial institutions in this country, a group that we bailed out when their greed and recklessness brought them to the edge of bankruptcy. Citigroup has paid no federal income taxes for the last 4 years after establishing 25 subsidiaries in offshore tax havens and receiving more than $2.5 trillion in total financial assistance from the Fed and the Treasury as part of the bailout. So they received huge amounts of money in bailouts. They now have 25 subsidiaries offshore, paid no federal income taxes for the last four years. 2009, ExxonMobil, which has historically been one of the most profitable corporations in the world, ExxonMobil made $19 billion in profits, and in 2009, not only did Exxon avoid paying federal income taxes that year, they actually received a $156 million rebate from the IRS, on and on and on and on. So you got the energy companies, you got Wall Street, either paying nothing or very, very little in federal taxes. So the debate that we're having right now is a pretty simple one. You have the Republicans saying that, oh yeah, well, all of these corporations are paying nothing in taxes. Some of them are getting rebates. Well, that's fine. The real way to do deficit reduction is to cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education, nutrition, infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. What some of us are saying, progressives are saying, excuse me, we have already seen massive cuts as part of deficit reduction, well over $1 trillion. And now we do have to ask the wealthy and large corporations to help us with deficit reduction. That's the big debate. Unfortunately, on this issue, the president has not been playing a particularly good role of late. As you know, he is out with dinner and for lunch with a bunch of Republicans. And what they are talking about, by the way, is some type of what they call a grand bargain, which would almost definitely include cuts in Social Security and cuts in benefits for disabled veterans. And that is something, as chairman of the Veterans Committee, that I will very, very strongly oppose. So what the debate about deficit reduction is number one, how do you do it in a way that's fair? Number two, to make sure that we do not forget that while deficit reduction is a serious issue and we are making some progress there, what's a more serious issue is creating the millions of jobs that working families need and jobs that pay a living wage.
We have a jobs crisis, not a budget crisis. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Sanders taking your calls up next here on our National Town Hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. Check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov, for his newsletter and all the news of the day.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And one of our callers today is going to receive a free signed copy of my book, Cracking the Code, Political Communications, sent to you by stamps.com. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program, and Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, taking your questions, and Tom in San Francisco. Tom, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
So they told me to phrase this in the idea of a question, and you've sort of answered it a bit already, but I was wondering if it would be possible to raise the cap of FICA, income tax cap up to $500,000, but at the same time then reduce the FICA tax rate itself by 25%, by 25% lower than what it is. Because I want to see Republicans go on the floor and argue against a tax cut.
Tom, you make a good point. I mean, there are a variety, what Tom is saying, so let's be clear. Right now, we have a kind of a flat tax on FICA, Social Security tax. It's 6.2%. Employers pay 6.2%. So if you make $113,000, you're paying 6.2%. You make $50,000, you're paying 6.2%. Interestingly, and I think this is the point that Tom is getting, right now, the cap is at $113,000. Somebody makes $1 million, somebody makes $113,000. They're both paying the same amount into the system. If you lift the cap, and what Congressman DeFazio and I did is we didn't start at $114,000. We said, all right, wait a second. We're going to go all the way up to $250,000. So somebody making $249,000 is not going to pay any more than he does today. But once you're earning more than $250,000, that cap is lifted, and you are going to pay based on your total income. If you do that, you will bring in at least another 50 years of Social Security solvency. What Tom is suggesting, there's another way to do it, is you could bring in more money, and you can lower that 6.2% to 4% or whatever you want to do it. You can do it that way. For simplicity's sake, we kept it the way it is now, just lifting the cap with the goal of making sure that Social Security would be solvent for the next 50 years.
Wendy in White Lake, New York. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a brief question about the important climate change legislation that you and Senator Boxer introduced. First, could you amend the definition of carbon-polluting substance to include the extraction process of natural gas, even if it's going to be exported, because this is precisely the phase during which much of the methane that contributes like 25 to 33 times more climate change.
Well, Wendy, you're right to be concerned about methane. What we did, again, for the sake of simplicity, we imposed Senator Boxer and I imposed the carbon tax on approximately the largest 3,000 polluters in the country, people who are emitting the most carbon emissions. So it applies to anybody who is one of the largest 3,000 emitters, which would account for about 85% of the carbon emission. So rather than imposing a tax on thousands and thousands and tens and tens and tens of thousands of entities, we figured what would be the best way to go, the simplest way to go, is to go after the very biggest. It turns out to be about 3,000 who emit about 85% of the emissions, no matter how those emissions are created. So certainly the answer to your question is yes, if they're one of the top 3,000 who constitute about 85% of the emissions. But the bottom line here, let me just say a word on that as a member of both the environmental and energy committees. I hope everybody understands that climate change is real. It is already causing devastating problems to our planet. What the leading scientists who study this issue tell us that if we don't get our act together, the temperature of this planet could rise by 7, 8, 9 degrees by the end of the century. That would mean major cities in the United States of America underwater all over the world, coastal cities underwater, severe drought, extreme weather disturbances. I mean, real chaos for this planet. And one of the issues that bothers me the most is that despite the dire projections of leading scientists all over the world, we have a Congress that refuses to even acknowledge in a serious way the problem, let alone address it. So, Wendy, this is an issue we're going to continue to work on.
Rusty in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Good. I had a question about the government funding fire, EMS, and police. It seems that the crime rate's been up very, very high.
Pardon. We're going to drop that. And my apologies to any of our station. I think that we caught that guy's obscenity, but my apologies to anybody who might have caught it. Chris in Fairfax, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator Sanders, I'd like to know whether you would filibuster any cuts or damages to the Social Security program.
Well, Chris, I'm leading, you know, you can't do a filibuster every day. I am chairman of the Defending Social Security Caucus. I've been leading the effort, and I will continue to lead the effort. So the kind of tactics we will use as we proceed down the pike is something that we're thinking about. Certainly a filibuster is one of the options that's available. And I want to point out something, though, in terms of the so-called chain CPI, because I want everybody to know what it means. When we talk about cutting Social Security, what we are talking about is the mechanism that they're going to use. And as I said earlier, it's not just Republicans who are talking about it. This is exactly what Obamas are talking about. Is they say, here's their argument. They say, you know, the way we calculate cost of living increases for disabled vets and people on disability and older people on Social Security, it has been too generous, and we have to cut back on that, make it skimpier. The result of that, and I disagree with that assertion, I think if you talk to most seniors, what they will tell you is that they spend a lot of money, by definition, on health care, on prescription drugs, and on keeping warm in the winter, and on food. And those costs, in fact, have gone up by and large more than general inflation, not less. Tom, I guess we'll continue this discussion in a moment.
Yep. We certainly will. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, 28 minutes past the hour. Check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. You can sign up for the Bernie Buzz, a free newsletter. It's a lot of great information in there. And also every day, the website is updated with the latest news.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back with more of your calls and questions for Bernie right after this, 28 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. It's our Brunch with Bernie. Our Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. And Corky in Hilton, New York, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello. Hello, Senator Sanders.
Hi.
I would like to know when you're going to reintroduce that bill on outsourcing and cutting off the tax breaks. Now, if you would please do a favor for me. I commend President Obama for trying to raise the minimum wage to $9 an hour. But in a single-income family, that's only $360 a week. Could you please walk that over to Paul Ryan and ask him to budget a family of four, single income, on $360 a week? That's housing, gas, insurance, retirement, all the necessities it takes to live in a family. Could you please walk that over to him and tell me how you live on that?
Well, Corky, thank you very much for your two-part question, and I think your point about minimum wage is exactly right. I will support raising the minimum wage. I would like it to go higher than $9 an hour, but that's a start. But your point is, even if we do have it at $9 an hour, it's $360 a week. That's less than $20,000 a year. And people can't live on that, especially if you have kids. But I should tell you that whether I walk it over to Ryan or not, we're going to have very little or virtually no support from Republicans on raising the minimum wage. And we're just going to have to develop the kind of grass movement which gives them an offer they can't refuse. I think we can raise the minimum wage, but at this point I'm not sure that we have Republican support. Your second point about doing away with these tax breaks, the companies who put their money into the Cayman Islands and other tax havens receive, we have already introduced that bill. And that bill would bring in a huge amount of money, over $500 billion a year. Right now we are seeing, as I mentioned earlier, many, many corporations on Wall Street and in other sectors stashing their money in the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, and other tax havens where they're paying zero taxes, and they're able to avoid paying taxes to the United States of America. You know, and I get particularly upset that many of these Wall Street companies
Wall Street to financial institutions that were bailed out by the American people. They were just very proud to be American when they were being bailed out by the middle class of this country because of their greed and recklessness. But when it comes to paying taxes, they don't consider themselves American. I guess they're Cayman Islanders. So my thought is the next time they go broke, let the Cayman Islands bail them out, not the American taxpayer. But be that as it may, we have reintroduced that bill. It's, I think, an intelligent bill, which will not only bring in revenue, create tax fairness in the United States, but also help us create jobs. So that's where we are on that one.
Okay, Bob in Clifton, Tennessee. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you, Tom. Good afternoon, Senator.
Good afternoon.
I live in a rural area where FedEx and UPS drop off parcels at the post office for end-of-the-line delivery.
Correct.
I would like to know if they pay full price for that delivery, and if not, why not?
Bob, that's a great question that I don't have the information in front of me to give you. They work out a contract with the Postal Service. And Bob's point is that all over America, in rural areas, it is the United States Postal Service which actually brings the package to people's homes. But I will tell you, Bob, that we are very, very concerned about some of the ideas coming from the Inspector General regarding, not the Inspector General, but the Postmaster General regarding the future of the Post Office. And we've been engaged in this issue for the last several years. Their latest idea is to eliminate Saturday mail delivery for first-class mail, which we think is a bad idea. Previously, they had talked about cutting down about half of the mail distribution centers in the country and about half of the rural post offices in America, some 15,000 of them, shutting them down. We have fought back successfully, and while some changes are taking place, hours in rural post offices have been reduced. They haven't been shut down. So we're making some progress in preventing the kind of draconian cuts that some people are talking about. That fight is going to resurface very, very soon. I've introduced legislation in the Senate, which I think has about 10 co-sponsors, which would strengthen the post office. And the major problem, Bob, Postal Service has is that right now about 80% of their financial problems has to do with an onerous burden on the post office calling for something like $5 billion a year payments for healthcare, for future healthcare retiree benefits. And no other entity in the government, no other entity in the private sector has to do that. So we are working very, very hard to save the Postal Service, to give them new options to raise revenue so they continue to do the work they are all over America.
Reginald in Houston, Texas, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hey, yes, how you guys doing? Yes, I want to, you know, on filibustering, the Rand Paul, he stood up against, you know, against the nomination there of the CIA director, had issue with the drones, the one with killing surveillance and the NDAA. I think that should have been maybe a bipartisan thing to stand up against. In my opinion, that was a real valiant thing that he did. And sometimes, you know, when you speak out against the United States, they call you non-patriotic. They did that with Dr. King when he spoke up against the war. And speaking on that, when Chavez, in his death, when he spoke out against some wars or some things that, you know, we do here in America, says like when we did the wars and we explored our power. And
Reginald, is there a question in there for Bernie?
The question is, how did he feel about the filibustering, and also what did he think about Chavez's death in that regard? Okay. As far as
thank you very much. Thanks, Reginald.
I think I dropped the questions. Well, you know, I respect anybody. You know, Rand Paul and I have very, very different points of view. Rand Paul, I think we consider things like Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid unconstitutional. He imposed drastic cuts. We just talked about the Postal Service. My guess is he would wipe out the Postal Service tomorrow. He would protect and defend tax breaks for very wealthy individuals. So his views and mine on many, many issues are completely in opposition to each other. I respect somebody who's going to go to the floor for 12 hours and speak. I ended up voting against Mr. Brennan, not because, as Senator Paul suggested, that he thought the United States and Barack Obama would be sending drones into a cafe in San Francisco to blow people up. I think that's totally absurd. I mean, and really dangerous rhetoric. But because I continue to believe, as I have for many years, that our intelligence agencies are not respectful enough of civil liberties. The United States is facing some very dangerous enemies who want to do us harm. And we have to be vigilant in defeating them and arresting them and killing them when necessary. But at the same time, I believe that as we engage in that struggle, we can protect the constitutional rights of the American people. And I'm not sure that our intelligence agencies or Mr. Brennan have been as cognizant of that as they should.
Noah in Madison, Wisconsin.
Hello?
You're on the air with Senator Sanders, Noah. Noah? Hello, Noah? Noah is not there. Merlene in Morriston, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Merlene? Do we have a problem, Houston? Bernie, you're still there, right?
I'm here.
Okay, well, that's a good sign. Let's try Johnny in Vacaville, California. Johnny, can you hear us?
I can hear you. Can
okay,
you hear me?
You're on the air. Yeah, go for it.
Oh, great. Hi, Senator Sanders.
Hi, Johnny.
Nice to talk to you both today. The reason I called, my question has to do with another tax loophole that's been used by Facebook, I know, in the past year and probably many other companies. It's a stock hole where they issued their employees' stock as income rather than paying them salaries. And that allows the company to deduct that from their income tax, so they pay no income tax on that money. And their employees pay no income tax on the money. So the employees escape paying income tax, and the employer, that is, in this case, the example being Facebook, avoids paying taxes because of the stock issuance loophole. I'm wondering if that's in your bill.
Well, that is not in the bill that that I've just discussed. The bill that I have discussed talks about ends tax havens in the Cayman Islands and elsewhere, by which people are parking huge amounts of money and avoiding paying U.S. Taxes. What you're talking about, Johnny, is something, frankly, I'm not familiar with. But what I do know is there are a zillion ways out there that smart accountants and can avoid paying, having their companies avoid paying taxes. And we have all kinds of lobbyists out there working night and day to create the loopholes that enable these these accountants to avoid paying taxes. So thank you for that. But it's one of many. And that speaks to the need to simplify the tax system, do away with these loopholes, and make sure that we have a progressive tax system in which the wealthiest people in this country stop paying their fair share.
Yeah, okay. We're just 10 seconds from the break here, Bernie. Totally in agreement. And maybe even changing the Mitt Romney loophole, the capital gains loophole?
Absolutely. I mean, that's just an example. Somebody asked me earlier why it is that, you know, working people pay higher tax rates than wealthy, and that's, again, the capital gains loophole is certainly one of those reasons.
Right. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. It's 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with more of your calls for Senator Sanders right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Check out Senator Sanders' website at sanders.senate.gov. And you can sign up for the Bernie Buzz there. Great newsletter. Welcome back. It's Brunch with Bernie, our national town hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders answering your questions. Noah in Madison, Wisconsin. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom and Senator Sanders. It's good to be with you. So before I get to my question, I just wanted to make a comment. I have a fourth cousin. We share a great-great-great-grandfather, Nicholas Abler, together, and this cousin of mine is named Congressman Paul Ryan. I would like to get a message out to my cousin asking him to work with Democrats and Senator Sanders to not cut Social Security, to raise the cap on FICA taxes for Medicare and Social Security. But my question is, Ben Bernanke once commented that in order to get quantitative easing to benefit federal, state, and local governments, instead of just buying up toxic assets of commercial banks, then the Federal Reserve Act would have to be repealed or rewritten somehow. I wonder if Senator Sanders could comment on that.
Well, first point is, good luck with your cousin. I hope you can use your familiar ties to urge him to do the right thing, but I wouldn't hold my breath about Thanksgiving dinner going well. Second point, in terms of the Fed, it is an issue that we are working on. It's a very tough issue because to make any significant reforms would require taking on Wall Street. And Wall Street, Noah, as I think you know, is just unbelievably powerful, pretty much own the Republican Party and a significant part of the Democratic Party as well. We have tried to bring forth, we've done a couple of things. Probably up to now, the most successful thing that I did is part of Dodd-Frank, we got an audit of the Fed during the emergency bailout period, which told us extraordinary facts that we otherwise would not have known. That among other things, the Fed provided zero interest or almost zero interest loans to the tune of $16 trillion in a revolving loan fund to every major financial institution in America and many central banks all over the world. What we were working on now was something a lot more modest, which has also run into a tough opposition. And that is right now the regional banks, many of the members of the regional banks are appointed by the bankers themselves. And we had the absurd situation where in the New York Fed, Jamie Dimon, the CEO of JP Morgan Chase, was sitting on the Fed, supposedly regulating large financial Wall Street institutions, which seemed to me to be very much a question of the fox guarding the hen house. So we are working on Fed reform, but it's a tough issue because of the power of Wall Street.
Jeff in Portland, Oregon. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Thank you, Tom, for taking my call, and it's an honor to speak to you and Bernie. I just wanted to say, first off, in regards to the filibuster, you know, Chris Hedges has a lawsuit against the administration over provisions in the NDAA as relates to that filibuster. And it'd be great to hear him talk about it on the show if you can get him on. But my main thing with the filibuster was I was disappointed that progressives didn't stand up with him. I know my senator did, Ron Wyden. I want to thank him for doing that. And I know my other senator, Merkley, voted no on Brennan, as you did too, Bernie. Thank you for doing that. But that leads me to my question. With the lack of progressives getting involved in a matter like that, and if President Obama cut Social Security, Medicaid, or Medicare or Medicaid, doesn't it signal almost the death of liberalism in the Democratic Party, and which actually, you know, did start with Clinton making deals like NAFTA and deregulating the banks, and with only a quarter of the Progressive Caucus signing on to the Grayson-Takano letter, are progressives really doing enough, Bernie, to stop this slide with President Obama getting ready to cut these fundamental programs?
Well, thank you for the question, Jeff. You know, that's kind of a mouthful that you've asked, you know, very important question, which would take more than a few minutes to really answer in an effective way. But let me just say this. What you have now politically in America is a very significant movement to the right in terms of both political parties. The Republican Party, which traditionally has been a center-right party, is now pretty much a right-wing extremist party. The Democratic Party, which has traditionally been a center-left party representing working people and so forth, has become pretty much a centrist party. I think the good things that the Democrats are doing is protecting, to a significant degree, women's rights. They have been very strong. Obama has been strong on issues like gay rights. We're making some progress in protecting the rights of Hispanics and others. But on economic issues, you're seeing both parties to a very significant degree controlled by big money and not doing the right thing. You know, whether it is trade policy, which you mentioned, that's kind of bipartisan, whether it is the willingness to take on Wall Street. Remember that it was under Clinton. Bob Rubin then was the Treasury Secretary. He worked with right-wingers like Alan Greenspan to deregulate Wall Street, which led us to the situation where we're in right now, where not only do we have to go through the horrendous financial collapse of Wall Street, but now we're seeing a handful of banks only owning a significant part of the assets of America. That was kind of bipartisan as well. So I would say on economic issues, Jeff, you're right. You have, you have some great people in the Democratic Party who are fighting for working people, but they are pretty much the minority. So there are differences between the parties, to be sure, on a number of important issues. Climate change. Republicans are literally living in denial. Democrats aren't, but Democrats are not doing enough to fight for the kinds of transformation of our energy system that we need. So are progressives doing enough? I think you got some people in the Progressive Caucus in the House who are doing a great job. Remember, they're fighting on you asked why weren't they on the floor on drones? Well, you know, they're fighting a million fights. We're fighting against the cuts in Social Security. We're fighting in terms of making sure that every American has health care as a right. We're fighting on climate change. We're dealing with a whole lot of stuff, so people can't do everything every day. But there's no question that we need a revitalized grassroots movement, strong labor effort to move this country in a progressive way.
And you're such an important part of that, Bernie. Thanks so much for being with us today. We will be back with more. Actually, we'll be back with Anything Goes, and Debbie Stabenow is going to be with us a little later on.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything Goes Friday. There's a few things we're going to talk about in the news as we go through the day, but we'll also sprinkle it with your phone calls. In fact, let's start out with that. John in Davidson, North Carolina. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how are you? I was on hold. I was going to ask the senator this question. It was about Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
It could be argued that it's morphed to something it really wasn't intended when it was first started in the 40s.
It was started in 1935.
As far as with the actual, it was created, but I think the first payout or the first person to collect a check is somewhere a few years after that.
Right? 1936.
Full Social Security benefits started at 65, and the life expectancy back then was 63. So clearly, people are living longer.
No, you're wrong. You're wrong, John. The only people who are living longer right now, if you take infant mortality, 1935, we had not yet developed penicillin. I mean, that came out of World War II. We had the sulfa drugs from World War I. So a lot of children died in their first 5 years. They died from infections, typically. You had a lot of women who died in childbirth. You had children who died at a young age. If you strip infant mortality out of life expectancy figures, the average working person, the men, if you would just look at men who are of, who have middle class men, working class men, the life expectancy in 1935 and the life expectancy today is nearly identical. The group that is living older is the top 10% of income earners. The top 10% of income earners are living about a year and a half longer, but working class men are living about the same as they were in 1935. It's a canard. It's one of the lies that Pete Peterson and his bunch have been pushing because, they include those infant mortality statistics, which have nothing to do with Social Security. Infants who die at the age of a year or 3 weeks from a childbirth infection never pay into Social Security, never take money out of Social Security, but they do drag down the overall life expectancy rates, and they do so significantly because they're losing an entire 70 years.
Okay. I mean, point well taken. But my question to him was, or would be, how much stress on the system is the future payments of somebody, say, 45 or younger? In other words, the country did fine before Social Security was around.
No, it didn't.
Just phase it out.
The country was doing very badly, John, before 1935. You had more than half of all people over 65, first of all, in 1935, were living in poverty, and Social Security cut that down into the high teens, low 20s, in total, terms of percentage. Right now it's below 15%, I believe, as a result of Social Security. And if you did away with Social Security altogether, it would pop back up into the mid-30% range. So number one, no, the country wasn't doing well. And secondly, and I think probably the most important thing, is that one-third of all Social Security payments do not go to people over 65. They literally go to people like my niece, who was born with spina bifida, or bifida, however you say it, and profoundly retarded, never learned how to speak. She lived until she was about 20 years old. She's the daughter of my cousin. So yeah, she's my niece. So and my cousin and her husband had to quit his job to care for her. They couldn't afford to hire somebody to care for her. Social Security filled in the chinks there for them, and Social Security, you know, paid for many of her health expenses. So without Social Security, she would have been dead, and my cousin and her husband would have been destitute. One of my best friends, Michael Hutchison, who's more or less my age, he's a little bit younger than me, a couple of years younger than me, back almost 20 years ago, he was running in Santa Fe in the winter. He was he was one of these guys who runs, you know, 4 or 5 miles every morning just to keep in shape. He was running in the dark in the morning, crossing a bridge with a fairly low guardrail, hit a patch of ice, flipped off the bridge, cracked through the ice, hit his head against the rocks, broke his neck. He's been paralyzed from the neck down ever since, and he's living on Social Security. And you know, there's without Social Security, Michael would be dead now. And as it is, I mean, he's basically destitute. Social Security does not provide much, but a third of all Social Security payments go to people like them or like Paul Ryan. When Paul Ryan's dad died, his family qualified for Social Security. And you know, the widow, orphan, and survivor's benefits, that's a third of the payments. Social Security is an essential part of the fabric of America, John. And its program is not in trouble, by the way. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Still there?
All great points. I think that should be the platform of, you know, some of the Democrats. Yeah.
It is.
Addressing those points, because they're all valid points, but I hear them from you, but I don't hear them from too many folks in Washington.
Well, one of the problems is that there's so much money being spread around this town. I mean, Pete Peterson himself is estimated to spend more than $400 million. He pledged publicly that he would spend over $1 billion. If you go to petersonpyramid.org, you can, you know, check this out, in order to privatize Social Security. Social Security is sitting on a $2.7 trillion trust fund, a surplus, because Reagan saw the boomers coming, and this was one of the good things that Ronald Reagan did. One of the two good things that I regularly honor him for on this show. One, he made Social Security solvent, even though there's this huge bulge coming through the, you know, rabbit through the python of the baby boomers. And he said, okay, we're going to have one generation that is not only going to pay for their parents, which is how Social Security worked before 1982. In other words, working people paid in. There was no Social Security trust fund at all. Social Security zeroed out at the end of every year. People paid in, and retired people took benefits. And he said, you know, when the boomers start retiring, you're going to see that ratio of 5, 10, 15 people working for every retiree. It's going to drop down to 2, 3, 4, 5 people working for every retiree. There's no way we can afford to run the program that way. So one generation, the baby boomers, are going to be double taxed. They're not only going to pay for their parents' retirement, but they're going to pay for their own as well in advance. And so starting in 1982 and ending around 2030 or 2028 or something like that, Reagan doubled the Social Security tax. I mean, he literally doubled it. And the surplus, which was the boomers saving up for their own retirement, was put into the Social Security Trust Fund, which hits a peak of $2.7 trillion, which is where it's at right now. It was supposed to hit that peak. And then over the next 30 years, as the boomers die out, gets paid down to zero, which it's supposed to. And you hear these, again, you hear these Peterson front guys going, oh, my God, you know, the Social Security Trust Fund, it's starting to run out of money. We're going to be paying out of the Social Security Trust Fund pretty soon. Within 30 years, it'll be at zero. That's how it's supposed to work. That's the savings account for this one bulge, that generational bulge. And you know, it's Social Security is just fine. And with a very small tweak, I mean, these conservatives say, oh, why don't we have a flat tax? Why shouldn't a billionaire pay the exact same tax rate as somebody working at McDonald's? It's just 17% for everybody. Well, Social Security is arguably a flat tax, except Social Security, you pay, you know, what is it, 4.2% or whatever it is on the first $113,000 that you earn. And then after that, you don't pay a penny. How is that a flat tax? That makes no sense at all. So right now, Social Security is solvent for the next 27 years. Next 27 years. And then after that, it can pay out 80% of benefits forever. If we simply raised that $113,000 cap to a $500,000 cap, it would be solvent forever. And in fact, there'd be enough of a surplus that we could cut Social Security's tax rate by 2%, or we could fund about a third of Medicare. Or if we did away with the cap altogether and said, you know, the billionaires who are running Facebook and Microsoft and ExxonMobil and Stephen Hemsley over at United Healthcare making $1 billion running a health insurance company, they have to pay on every penny of their income, they have to pay Social Security tax as well. The program would be so incredibly solvent that you could cut in half the tax rate on average working people and everybody else and the billionaires as well, and it would be solvent forever. I mean, this program has no problem. The problem, the crisis, is a manufactured crisis by billionaires who want to move that money out of government keep and into Wall Street so that Wall Street can get their grubby little hands on $2.7 trillion in the Social Security Trust Fund. Because Wall Street will skim 15-20% off the top the same way the health insurance companies do.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And it's tragic that that's not a conversation that you hear in the mainstream corporate media, because that's not what the talking point. There's nobody, you know, nobody has a self-interest in sharing the truth with you like I just did. 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. And Steve in Portland, Maine. Hey, Steve, you have a question about the chain CPI?
Yeah, Tom, long-time subscriber, first-time caller.
Thank you.
Did you see Bill O'Reilly's outburst? It was the biggest story on MSNBC all week.
You mean where he was screaming at Alan Combs?
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw it. Yeah.
In my opinion,
I mean, I saw the clips of it. I don't watch Fox News.
Tell me I'm crazy. I don't want to believe this. Tell me that I'm paranoid to think that it's a put on, that it's too pat, and that it's something that has been orchestrated and choreographed in the background to make the president look like he's winning when he gives away CPI.
Well, that's what's going on. That's what's going
on.
No,
you think I'm not crazy.
No, you're not crazy, and you're not paranoid. This you are right.
But you think it's that Bill O'Reilly and is getting scripts from somebody that to say make it look like he's good because he's giving you this.
Well, no. What O'Reilly was freaking out and screaming at Alan Combs, because O'Reilly was basically saying, name one program that the president has said he's willing to cut, and Combs says Medicare. And O'Reilly goes, no, name one program. And Combs goes, Medicare and Medicaid, that's two. And no, you can't name a specific program the president's willing to cut. And, you know,
the fact of the matter is that
with a chain CPI, you are cutting, well, actually, you're cutting Social Security and veterans benefits more than anything else. And the president has said that he's willing to do this.
But the question is it fake?
I don't think so. I think that this administration, the White House, they do many good and noble things, and I'm a supporter of President Obama, broadly speaking, but I believe that if we don't call out an administration when they do something we disagree with, then we've lost our political independence, and we've also lost the ability to frankly influence them. You don't influence politicians by just sucking up to them. This is wrong, what the administration is talking about doing, the chain CPI. But the president, if the reports that we're reading are true, and I believe that they are, is calling Republicans saying, listen, if you'll put some taxes on the table, which, by the way, would blow up the Republican Party. I mean, this would be a serious blow to the Republican Party if any of them went along and said, yes, we will raise taxes. And that's why I think they won't. And so this may be a, 3D chess game that the president's playing, or it may just be, he's trying to play centrist. And I could argue either side. But he's saying, I will put cuts to Social Security and veterans benefits and Medicare on the table, and Medicaid. We will put these cuts on the table if you will put increasing the taxes on Mitt Romney on the table and the corporate CEOs.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm still here.
I understand all that. The question that I was trying to ask is something different.
Okay.
My question is, did they collude in this kabuki dance to make it look that way?
Who's
Bill O'Reilly
they?
And the president.
No, I don't think Bill O'Reilly's... No, in fact, my point was that Bill O'Reilly is not willing to take yes. He, you know, the president says, yeah, sure, we'll cut this. And Bill O'Reilly has to behave for his audience like the president's an unreasonable ideologue. And that's why he was screaming.
But you see the power of that to the Democrats. Oh, well, we're winning because Bill O'Reilly's made a fool of himself. Well, we're actually losing.
I know. I agree. I absolutely agree, Steve. And,
okay,
and,
well,
and it's a sad commentary on our media that people aren't pointing out what I just pointed out.
I love your show, and keep up the good work.
Okay, thanks a lot, Steve. Thanks for listening. J.D. in Monticello, Arkansas. Hey, J.D., what's up?
Well, hi, Tom.
Hello.
I was calling in because all these people are wanting to cut Social Security. I have a neighbor who's 40 years old, has been had surgery 4 times for brain cancer.
Ouch.
If it weren't Social Security, the man would have nothing.
Yeah, this is the same situation as my friend Michael, who in his 30s, I think he was in his mid to late 30s, broke his neck. And he would be, you know, he's in his 50s now, and he would be dead today if it wasn't for Social Security.
Well, I'm 73 years old, and quite frankly, I ain't making it on Social Security.
Yeah. Well, and this is because the cost of living adjustments have not been keeping up with the actual cost of living, particularly the cost of food, transportation, and medicine over the last 20 years or so. And, you know, when Reagan reconfigured the way Social Security operated, one of the things that he did was he reconfigured the way that they calculate the cost of living adjustments. So people could live on Social Security in 1981. Oh. They can't now. And, you know, point well made, J.D. But, you know, that's something you need to be taking this up with your – you're in Arkansas. You got Jeff Sessions, and who's your other senator from Arkansas?
Oh, we've got Pryor and some clown out west.
Yeah.
Right-wing whack job.
Yeah, well, you know, even though they're right-wing whack jobs, they need to be hearing from you, and you need to be telling them, you know, not only do not cut Social Security, do not go along with the chain CPI, even if the president suggests it, not only don't do that, but it's time to start raising Social Security benefits. It's time to tie Social Security benefits to a cost of living that actually reflects what it costs to live on Social Security. You know, they put the cost of computers and things into Social Security. People living on Social Security are not buying a new computer every year. They're not buying a new car every year. They are buying food, they are buying medicine, they are buying housing, and they are buying transportation. And those things are underestimated in the way that Social Security cost of living adjustments, whether it's for a 35-year-old quadriplegic or whether it's for a 73-year-old retired person. Those things are underestimated in the way that those numbers are calculated. And the other message that, and thank you for the call, JD, the other message that we need to get out to the 20-somethings in America, the 30-somethings, the 40-somethings, the Gen Xers, the millennials, that we absolutely have to get out to young people in this country and to students is you have right now an insurance policy that covers you for the rest of your life against disaster. It's called Social Security. And you need to be doing everything you can to strengthen it and to make it work for everybody, because it's there for everybody. It's a powerful and strong program, and it's a solvent program. And to have people come along and say, well, you know, we'll cut back on this or that. Come on, this is crazy. Just have Bill Gates pay the same amount into it that everybody else does.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And while we're at it, let's adopt the Buffett rule and say that, you know, Warren Buffett has to pay the same taxes that his secretary does, which is what he's asking for. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Anything Goes Friday. And it's, you know, it's been kind of an interesting day news-wise. Unemployment is at a 4-year low. We're back, you know, sort of before the crash, but, you know, the big problem, of course, is that 800,000 jobs in the public sector, in the government sector, have been knocked off over the last 4 years, mostly by Republican governors in red states. And now with the sequester, there's another 700,000 people are going to lose their jobs. So it's going to get tight. And this is all because the Republicans have made this absolute commitment to devastate this economy so that President Obama gets blamed for it. It's just remarkable. It's absolutely remarkable. Ralph in Pleasant Plains, Illinois. Hey, Ralph, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Always enjoy the show. I'm a regular listener and want you to know that that your efforts and the efforts of Bernie Sanders are very much appreciated, probably more than you know. I'm calling in concern about, as I think a lot of us are, about the polarization and Republican obstructionism of Congress regarding issues that are important to working-class people here in the U.S. And I'm wondering if you could speak to the issue of ballot referenda, how issues ultimately get placed on the ballot, and what can be done to expand the process to allow middle-class and working-class Americans to more of an opportunity to vote directly on issues that are not being successfully addressed in Congress now.
Yeah. Ralph, it's kind of a good news, bad news scenario. The good news is back around the turn of the century when the United States Senate was appointed rather than elected by the states, and each state could decide how they sent their two senators to Congress. There were states, in most states, they were selected by the state legislatures. And as a consequence of that, people running for Senate literally were buying off state legislators. And, you know, the most famous and blatant example of that was in Montana, where I'm forgetting his name now, but he was associated with what is now the Anaconda Copper Empire. It had a different name at the time. And this guy literally stood outside the state legislature with $1,000 bills, passing them out to anybody who voted for him. And he got sent to the United States Senate. And the senators at the federal level, the U.S. senators, were so offended by this guy bragging about it to the newspapers and telling everybody what he was doing that for a few days they refused to seat him in the Senate. And that Clark was his name? William Clark was his name. Thank you, Shino. And that led to a series of progressive reforms in a number of states. Montana was one of them, mostly Western states, mostly the newer states and the more progressive states, where California, Oregon, where I lived, where they said, okay, if the state legislatures are so corrupted by big money interests that they're not willing to do things in the interest of the people themselves can propose laws. They can put forward ballot initiatives and vote on them, and even, you know, whether it's an amendment to the Constitution or whether it's a law, they can do it. And so about a third of our states, somewhere between a third and a half of our states, have these direct ballot initiatives. They don't exist at the federal level. That's the good news. The bad news is that starting in particular in the 1970s, after Lewis Powell was put on the U.S. Supreme Court by Richard Nixon in 73, the United States Supreme Court started very aggressively ruling in a series of cases. The famous high water marks on this, or low water, as you, depending on how you want to interpret it, were Buckley versus Vallejo, First National Bank versus Bilotti, and Citizens United. But in a series of these decisions, the Supreme Court repeatedly argued that money is the same thing as speech, and that free speech is protected by the First Amendment. So therefore, money in political campaigns is protected by the First Amendment, and you can't limit it, you can't stop it, and you can't stop billionaires or very large nonprofit organizations or even for-profit organizations from playing in politics. And the consequence of this has been that in state after state, and the first that we saw of these was in the mid-70s with Howard Jarvis, who was a front man for the billionaires, you know, a well-intentioned one perhaps, but nonetheless a front man for the billionaires, with Proposition, what was it, 13 in California, I think it was called, where it said that your property taxes couldn't go up as long as you owned the house, which has led to all kinds of dislocations in California. And then the one that the right-wingers really love is that you can... the only way that you can increase taxes on people in a state is with a supermajority. You have to have a two-thirds or greater majority of votes in the House or in the Senate of the state to raise taxes. And they've got these things on the ballots, and they've convinced people to vote for them. And we've reached because the Supreme Court has said that, you know, they're corporations, they're people, and money is speech. And the consequence of this is that some really toxic ballot measures have been passed. We saw this happen in the state of Oregon when I was living there, this two-thirds supermajority. There have been several of them in California. They so crippled the legislature, the ability of the legislature to do anything. I mean, the legislature literally could not raise taxes. So Jerry Brown got his own ballot measure on. He got enough people to sign it that the governor, the Democratic governor, that would raise the taxes because the legislature didn't have the number of votes to do it. You know, the Republicans would continuously obstruct this. So the bad news is that ballot measures have become, in many cases, in many states, a force for ill, you know, for evil, for bad legislation. And, you know, the ballot measures go to whoever pays the highest price. And even when a good ballot measure comes along that a lot of people want to see, like, hey, what about just labeling GMO food so that we know that it's GMO? The, you know, Monsanto and Dow come into the state and just pour an enormous amount of money into the state. And by doing so, they're saying, oh, this is going to raise the price of food. And people bought it hook, line, and sinker. And they wouldn't have been able to say that if they hadn't been declared persons as corporations and if speech hadn't been equated with, or money hadn't been equated with free speech under the First Amendment. So the ballot measure process has been bad, has been as badly corrupted as our political process. We are at a political crossroads in America right now, Ralph, where not only have our politicians been corrupted, but the entire system is corrupted, and we've got to get money out of this system. And the Supreme Court not only is not willing to do that, they're doubling down on what they've been saying for the last 30 years. So we need to pass a constitutional amendment, which is movetoamend.org. You can read it. Bernie Sanders is an advocate of this. Sherrod Brown is an advocate for it. Most of the progressives are. Some of the conservatives are. To amend the Constitution, Al Franken is running on this now, to amend the Constitution to say, number one, corporations are not people, and number two, money is not speech, it is property. Making sense, Ralph?
Here in Illinois, we had a referendum for an amendment to overturn Citizens United.
Right.
In November.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was the result of the efforts of movetoamend.org. They've gotten over 300 of these things passed all over the country. Unfortunately, they're not binding. They're resolutions. They're, you know, kind of will of the people statements. But they are getting the attention of politicians. And I think that, you know, I was talking with David Cobb about this two nights ago on our TV show, and he was saying, well, you know, I think it's going to be a few years, you know, before we see this thing happen. Maybe he was saying 10 years. I look at, you know, how long it took to get the 18-year-old vote, and it took about a year and a half, and it only took 3 months from the time it was dropped in Congress until the time it was voted on by the three-quarter state and made into, part of the Constitution. So I'm actually quite optimistic. Ralph, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. I really appreciate it. Chris in Columbus, Georgia. Hey, Chris, what's up? You want to talk about military budget cuts?
Yes, Tom, a long-time listener, first-time caller.
Thank you.
I consider myself more on the liberal side of things, which is kind of rare in my profession, I believe. But I think a lot of people who, A, listen to your show or watch MSNBC, you know, the military budget is an easy target for liberals. You know, I agree. I think we do need to cut the budget. But doing it the way the system is set up now, you aren't, you know, KBR is going to keep their contracts. Boeing is going to keep their contracts. The people you're hurting, and we've seen it already. We all got an email here the other day, today, saying that our tuition assistance was cut. So we can no longer, the Army is no longer going to pay for someone like me. I'm currently an active duty Army officer. No longer going to pay my tuition bill, or my soldiers is really the big thing. You know, I have 18, 19, 20, 22-year-old soldiers that make significantly less than $20,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
That one of the things that got them to join is like, hey, if you come into the military, not only when you get out, but while you're in, we'll pay for you to go to school. We'll pay for you to better yourself.
Right.
And now we're cutting the budget, and it's not hurting big corporations. It's not hurting KBR. It's hurting the young 22-year-old private that raised his right hand, decided he was going to put himself in harm's way and, you know, work his butt off. And let's be honest, these guys do, whether they're deployed or they're here. I can't remember the last time my guys put in less than 50 or 60 hours in a given week.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the people that are being hurt by this. It's not the big guys. It's not...
You're absolutely right. And this that you're talking about is sequestration.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of people on you know, that lean towards our, you know, mine and your political leanings kind of view this as a victory and say this is a good thing. We need to cut the military budget.
No, I don't.
And I agree.
You know, I think that we need to change some of our military policies, and out of that will come budget cuts. I mean, I'd also like to see the Pentagon just accountable. I mean, there's $2 trillion missing. Let's just have some audits. But
yeah,
my suggestion is, you know, we've got 700 foreign bases. Do we really need that? We need to seriously reconsider, you know, what kind of military do we want to have, and how to, you know, and frankly, I don't think we're spending anywhere near enough in the military on things like cyber warfare, which I'm convinced is going to be the next war. You know, we're going to PO somebody, and they're going to just brown out a couple of our cities. They don't have to nuke them anymore. They can just turn off the power, shut off the water.
The truth is, Tom, we're still fighting the Cold War. I mean,
yeah.
We're getting ready to buy a bunch of F-35 Joint Strike Fighters that were designed to dogfight Soviets over Siberia.
You're right. You're absolutely right. But but the larger point that you're making, Chris, is such an important point, and it deserves repeating, that the sequestration was stupid. It is something that needs to be undone. It needs to be undone right away because it's hurting average soldiers. It is hurting the wrong people. And you're absolutely right. The big corporations will figure out a way around it. Thanks.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Give us a call. Whatever's on your mind. Welcome back to Talk Media for the sane among us. And let's check in with Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Talk Radio News, of course, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com, Ellen Ratner's charity where you can give a goat to help a rescued slave in Sudan, and you receive a photo of your goat and the person you helped, or South Sudan, actually. Victoria Jones, TalkRadioNews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
Great to see you. What's up? What's going on in the world today?
Lots going on, including one very interesting story, several interesting stories, but one most unusual story. Suleiman Abu Ghaith, son-in-law of Osama bin Laden, who once served as a spokesman for al-Qaeda, pleaded not guilty at his arraignment in a federal court in Manhattan today. He has been charged with conspiring to kill Americans. Just the one count. This is what he's charged with. And apparently he's spoken at length with law enforcement officials after his arrest. There's a 22-page document that details his statements. We don't know what's in those statements, but he has apparently spoken. But he's entered not guilty plea. The government says they'll take 3 weeks to try him, and a date has not been set. Mitch McConnell, Senate Minority Leader, is not happy and says that he should be tried in Guantanamo Bay.
I was just going to ask, why, you know, where are the Republicans screaming about, oh, my God, he's related to Osama bin Laden, he must be radioactive.
They are screaming. Lindsey Graham says that the president snuck him in.
Oh.
McConnell says the decision of the president to import Suleiman Abu Ghaith solely for civilian prosecution makes little sense and reveals yet again a stubborn refusal to avoid holding additional terrorists at the secure facility at Guantanamo Bay. Now, we should bear in mind that conspiring to kill Americans is not a war crime.
Right, and it's a crime.
It's a crime.
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons why military experts are saying that he's being tried in an Article III court.
Right.
They've also had considerable success in Article III courts. Now, White House Deputy Press Secretary Josh Earnest said today, quite snarkily, that there's a broad consensus among the intelligence community. Said, with all due respect to Senator McConnell, that's not the assessment of the intelligence community. It's not the assessment of the Department of Justice. It's not the assessment of the Department of Defense. So we certainly welcomed his opinion, but that's not the assessment of the people who are responsible for protecting the national security of the United States of America.
Right. And just for the record, when you refer to an Article III court, you're talking about the third article of the Constitution, which establishes civilian courts. So basically you mean civilian courts as opposed to military courts.
Civilian courts as opposed to military courts, correct. And he talks about the success the government's had. I mean, there are a lot of terrorists during life sentences or very lengthy sentences who have been tried in downtown Manhattan.
Right, and they're in federal jails all over the country and no problem.
Right, and in fact there are some very nasty guys waiting for trial right now, alleged nasty guys waiting for trial right now. Three been extradited from Britain. Abu Hamza al-Masri, fiery Islamic preacher, been charged in the conspiring in a 1998 kidnapping of American other tourists in Yemen. Adil Abdul Bari, charged with conspiring in the 1998 bombings of two U.S. embassies in East Africa. They're going to be tried in Manhattan also.
In civilian courts. Well, this is, I see that as a really good sign. This is the administration walking back from that ledge of the United States is in a perpetual state of basically, military action of a militia state. What's the phrase? Not police state.
Perpetual war.
Yeah, that's a fine one. That's a fine
one. Yeah, and I think one of the things that's driving the Republicans mad, and Josh Earnest did not answer this question. He said he'd have to take the question. is that the Republicans are saying that Congress was not notified that this was going to happen. And Josh Earnest didn't answer the question. He perhaps didn't know the answer to the question of whether Congress was notified that he wasn't going to Guantanamo Bay, that he was going to be snuck in.
Right. But Congress is not notified when anybody's prosecuted, are they? I mean,
well,
for crime.
Generally speaking, they're not notified, and I strongly suspect, I'm speculating here, this is not news, I don't believe that the Obama administration did tell them, because I don't think they intended to.
No, and there's no reason for them to, frankly. You know, if you're going to try a criminal for a crime, you don't have to call up Congress and say, hey, guess what, you know, we just busted a bank robber, or a guy who's conspiring to kill Americans.
Right, I think they knew the significance of it, and just...
Okay,
very interesting case going on in Maryland. Justice Department's urging a court in Maryland to affirm individuals' rights to record police under the First Amendment, filing a statement of interest in support of a journalist suing over his arrest while photographing Maryland officers. I know this journalist extremely well, Manny Garcia, a White House and Senate credentialist photojournalist. He's told me his story, what happened to him.
Mm.
Basically, there's a statement filed this week in a federal court in Maryland. The DOJ is saying that not only do individuals have a First Amendment right to record police officers publicly doing their duties, they also have Fourth and Fourteenth Amendment rights protecting them from having those recordings seized without a warrant or due process, which is what happened to Manny Garcia when he started taking photographs of police very brutally arresting someone.
So the administration, the Obama administration, is standing up on the side of the right of individuals to photograph the police.
That's correct.
I'm impressed.
And Manny Garcia is suing the Montgomery County Police Department because he alleges he was.
Which court is this before? Is it the First Circuit?
This is going up before federal court in Maryland, so I don't know which court it is.
All right. Okay.
It's going to be a fascinating case.
Right.
He's already won once.
And whichever way it's decided, I guarantee you this is going to end up in front of the Supreme Court.
Yes, and there have been a number of cases nationwide with people going up against police, banning recording of individuals, and people are winning against the police.
As they should. I mean, this is common sense. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Victoria, thank you.
Thank you so much.
It's always great to hear from you, and your newscasts are invaluable. It's Anything Goes Friday today. We'll be back with more of the stories of the day, your comments, my thoughts, and an occasional rant right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
All right, voucher schools in Louisiana. This is hysterical. Louisiana and Indiana. Two states with right-wing crazy governors. John Kasich in Indiana, as I recall, isn't... No, it's Mitch Daniels? Mike Pence now. Yeah, you're right. Oh, geez. Genuinely toxic. And Louisiana. They're using so-called U.S. history textbooks in their eighth-grade classes that say that... I mean, this is truly bizarre. Truly bizarre. The Ku Klux Klan was a force for good. I'll read you the actual text. The Ku Klux Klan in some areas of the country tried to be a means of reform, fighting the decline in morality and using the symbol of the cross. Klan targets were bootleggers, wife beaters, and immoral movies. That would be those movies where you had black people in them, maybe. I don't know. In some communities, it achieved a certain respectability as it worked with politicians. Bob Jones University rewrites the history of the Ku Klux Klan. This is another. Here's another quote from one of the history books that are used in the voucher schools. These are the you know, the schools where you and I, the taxpayers, are paying for them because, you know, government gives vouchers to parents and then the parents can use those money in the schools. And these are the schools. These are the books they're using. Most of the slaves in the Old South, they had it really good. They were treated well. And here's the exact phrase. A few slaveholders were undeniably cruel. Examples of slaves beaten to death were not common, though. Neither were they unknown. The majority of slaveholders treated their slaves well. If I come up to you and put a collar around your neck and say, I'm going to take you home and you're going to work for me for the rest of your life. And by the way, you cannot get married. And if you have children, I own them and I can sell them. No matter how friendly I am, how is that considered treating you well? I mean, seriously. Here's another one. I haven't yet gotten to the one that's really got me fried. But here's another quote from the textbooks that the taxpayers of Indiana and Louisiana are paying for students in Indiana and Louisiana to study. Can you just imagine when these kids hit college? Listen to this. Dinosaurs and humans were definitely on the earth at the same time, and they may have even lived side by side within the past few thousand years. Dinosaurs and humans. That verbatim quote out of the textbook, Bible-believing Christians cannot accept any evolutionary interpretation. Dinosaurs and humans were definitely on the earth at the same time and may have even lived side by side within the past few thousand years. It's from Life Sciences, 3rd edition, Bob Jones University Press, 2007. Textbook used in the voucher schools in Indiana and Louisiana. Fire-breathing dragons may actually have existed. Is it, quoting from the book, is it possible that a fire-breathing animal really existed? Today, some scientists are saying yes. They have found large chambers in certain dinosaur skulls. Large skull chambers could have contained special chemical-producing glands. When the animal forced the chemicals out of its mouth or nose, those substances may have combined and produced fire and smoke. Really? Who are those scientists who are saying that? Maybe they're scientists who, when they went to school, learned that dinosaurs and humans hung out together. And that's why we wrote about fire-breathing dragons in the Bible. And then the most bizarre part, speaking as somebody who in the 60s was proudly a hippie, and I take a shower every day. I have my whole entire life. I never knew any hippies we had long hair. But, you know, the dirty hippie thing, it's really funny. I remember the first time I heard my son use that phrase. And, you know, who had, you know, was not old enough to remember the hippies, the real hippies. And I'm like, hippies are not dirty. Hippies were pretty clean. Hippies were, you know, these were political statements. This was the counterculture. Well, here's what they're teaching in the schools in Louisiana and Indiana. They went to Canada or European countries to escape being drafted into military service. Many young people turned to drugs and immoral lifestyles. These youth became known as hippies. They went without bathing, wore dirty, ragged, unconventional clothing. Hey, I'll cop to the unconventional, but I washed my clothes. And deliberately broke all codes of politeness or manners. Really? I don't remember that. And I was there. Rock music played an important part in the hippie movement and had a great influence over the hippies. Every generation has its music. Many of the rock musicians they followed belonged to Eastern religious cults or practiced Satan worship. Satan worship, really, and hippies. Somehow I missed that part of the 60s. It goes on, but, you know, what can I say? Somebody's got to defend the hippies. It's so funny. I won't tell the story. There's so many. But Craig wants to tell me that the sequester ain't all that bad in Calabasas, California. Hey, Craig, you want to talk about
the
sequester?
Hey, Tom, how are you? I'm a long, longtime listener, and I'm a fiscal conservative. I really do like your show, though. I listen for a different perspective, and I think you're fair. I guess my concern is the way the sequester is being bandied about in the media. It's these archaic cuts, but in reality, we're just cutting the amount of growth from year to year. So my question to you is, if we don't have the money to spend, should we be spending additional dollars in the future that we may or may not have? Are you okay with the constant increase in government spending? That's my question.
Short answer, yes. I don't think that our government spending is anything close to what it should be. But let me push back on some of the points that you made. Number one, large chunks of the federal budget are not affected by the sequester. They were exempted from the sequester. So, yes, the sequester is slowing down the rate of increase of government spending overall. But because about half of the government spending is not being affected by the sequester, that means that those parts that are being affected actually are being cut below the level of inflation. So if you want to take 100% of the federal budget and compare it with all of the cuts that are in the sequester, then, yeah, the sequester is cutting at less than the rate of inflation, so it's slowing the rate of growth. But if you just look at the programs that are actually cut by the sequester, they are being cut at more than the rate of inflation, so those are real cuts. Make sense?
Okay. Well, so, no, it does. I understand.
Whoever's telling you that, oh, don't worry about this, it's just fine, they're just slowing the rate of growth, they're lying to you. They're classically illustrating the old saying that figures don't lie, but liars can figure.
Right. And you and I've spoken before. I'm a guy who makes a nice living in California, that now under the new tax laws, I'm at 39.6% Fed, and my state taxes with Prop 30 have now at the high end gone up to about 12.3%. So before deductions, I'm over 50%. We've had this conversation before, and
you are one of the privileged few, Craig. I guarantee you that 99% of the people listening to this program right now would do pretty much anything to swap places with you, at least in terms of income, and be glad to pay those taxes and more.
So then,
the 39% that you're paying and the 50% that you're paying, you're not paying that on your first $10,000 of income, and you know it. You're not paying that on your first $20,000 or $30,000 or $40,000 of income, and you know it. You're not paying it on your first $50,000 or $60,000 or $70,000 of income, and you know that. You're only paying it on the top marginal dollars that you're making. You're paying it on the second $100,000, the third $100,000, the fourth $100,000 that you're making, and to claim that you're paying it on all of your income is disingenuous, Craig. People need to understand how progressive taxation works. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I mean, Craig on his first $50,000 of income is paying the exact same tax rate as somebody making $50,000 a year. Why is he complaining? 20 minutes past the hour, James O'Keefe, the right-wing fraudster, the guy who, walked into an Acorn office and on film said, hey, you know, I want to basically scam the voter registration system and the voter system and immigration? I think it might have been, I've got some illegal immigrants, or whatever it was. And the Acorn guy, he said he had a hooker with him and, he was playing super pimp and, yeah, housing vouchers, I guess, whatever it was. And the guy who said, all through the thing on tape, soon as James O'Keefe left, called the police on this guy. Somehow that didn't make it into the Fox News reports. The guy got fired. Acorn got taken down by Congress over a sting that was a lie. And James O'Keefe has now admitted that it was a lie, although he does not admit guilt, but he's paying $100,000 in damages to the guy who lost his job, which is nothing. I mean, this guy was nationally humiliated. He was lied about by Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity and all the other Fox so-called news talking heads, and it made its way from there into the rest of the mainstream media. An entire organization that was doing good and noble work was slandered, and James O'Keefe now is this criminal, or at least a moral criminal. He's not been convicted of a crime, but it seems to me that what he did, the selective editing of the videotape to take a person who is not a public figure and smear them in public, well, it speaks for itself. So, number one. Number two, Elizabeth Warren. She's asking the question of the banking regulators. Why does HSBC, the British bank, that has been convicted of laundering drug money for drug guys and terrorist money for terrorists? They've been convicted of this. You got guys in Guantanamo who are in Guantanamo for doing this. This bank is still doing business in the United States. Why? Elizabeth Warren wants to know. God bless her. Jerry in Amityville, New York. Hey, Jerry. Thanks for listening to WWRL. What's up?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, on Social Security and Medicare, Senator Sanders earlier today on your show, he mentioned that there's talk once again about a grand bargain between the White House and congressional Republicans that would cut Social Security.
Right.
And also President Obama, once again this past week, he seemed to be having his kumbaya moment, in my opinion, with Republicans, inviting even such Medicare endangering Republicans,
as,
for instance, Paul Ryan over for lunch. Yeah, so my concern is this. My concern is that a grand bargain with Republicans will end up being turned into a grand political sellout with respect to either Social Security or Medicare or both. And these are earned benefits that people paid into through the payroll taxes. And they're also social safety nets. And when it comes to either breaking or putting holes in and destroying these social safety net programs, I cannot understand why any Democrat would be joining Republicans in doing this. And I don't understand also, with respect to the chain CPI, since Social Security has long been called the third rail of politics, and also since the chain CPI, as we know, would greatly reduce Social Security cost of living adjustments as we know them, and it would end up putting less money in the pockets of the poorest elderly and disabled Social Security beneficiaries. They said, can you tell me, Tom, why any Democrat in their right mind would join elitist and overly wealthy Republicans and think that this is either good politics or good policy to do the chain CPI and to support doing this?
Because the reason that the Democrats are going to cave on this and they're going to go along with this and the White House is pushing this, and Jerry, thanks for calling and raising the issue. The reason they're going to do it is because the Republicans control the House right now and because the Republicans are willing to filibuster in the Senate. And arguably that's because not enough Democrats showed up in House elections, although the Democrats did get 1.5 million more votes nationwide for the House of Representatives. Arguably it's because the Republicans, rigged the game with the filibuster, or with the gerrymandering. But, whatever, however you want to identify this, bottom line is the Republicans are going to damage the country, or the Democrats are going to have to compromise with them. I'm frankly of the opinion that the Democrats should say, go ahead and damage the country. The Democrats, though, the calculus that they're making, and I absolutely understand this, is if the Republicans damage the country badly, as they want to, as they're doing, frankly, if they are allowed to continue doing this and they get away with it, that the blame is going to fall on the president. Because the White House always gets blamed for, the country, the economy's in the tank. Who gets blamed? Do we think back to who was in Congress during Jimmy Carter's administration when inflation was high? Do we think back to who was in Congress during Reagan's administration when we had the biggest stock market crash in the history of the United States since, other than the Great Depression, before 2008? Do we think back to who was in Congress in 2008, 2007 and 2008, when the housing bubble burst in the stock market? No, we don't. Do we think who was in Congress during Herbert Hoover's time? Well, it was all Republicans, but, they control both houses. But still, people don't know that. So what the Republicans know is, with this minority position in the House of Representatives and this willingness to blow things up in the United States Senate with a filibuster, they know that they can inflict considerable damage on this economy, and that between now and 3.5 years from now, when the White House is at stake again, most Americans are not well informed and they will blame the president. And the proof of the fact that the Republicans know this is that they and their shills on television and radio are already referring to the sequester as the Obama sequester, when this was something that the majority of Democrats voted against, and the majority of Republicans voted for, and John Boehner said he got 98% of what he wanted. And their source for this that they're claiming is Bob Woodward, right? And then Bob Woodward comes out and goes, "Oh, the White House is threatening me." It turns out, no, that's enough. But this is the game that the Republicans are playing, and the Democrats are trying to behave in what they believe to be the best interest of the nation. And as such, they're having to appease people who are functionally terrorists. They're hostage takers. And personally, I would not go along. I would draw a line in the sand like Bernie Sanders is doing. But, you know, I get what they're doing.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I don't think it's right, but I get what they're doing. And it's possible that they won't do it if they hear from enough of us saying, "We've got your back, we're going to support you, even if this thing goes down." Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio Program, radio and TV program broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent. On Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio, on every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as TV on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and several hundred cable systems nationwide by the Free Speech TV Network. More people watch or listen to the Tom Hartman Program and more stations and outlets than any other progressive talk show in the world, which is kind of fun on some days and quite a responsibility on most. Senator Debbie Stabenow is on the line with us. She's co-sponsored with Representative Gary Peters legislation to develop some new clean auto technologies. Being from Michigan, she would know. Senator Stabenow, welcome back to our program. It's been too long since we've talked with you.
You know, Tom, it has. You're doing such a great job, and I can't imagine anything that I enjoy talking about more than creating good jobs, making things in America, new technologies, and the auto industry, which, by the way, is back, and we're glad to see it with the support of all of us to make sure we have an American automobile industry. So now we just need to keep it going and add new kinds of technologies that are going to be creating jobs and also making a cleaner environment.
Indeed. It is back, notwithstanding the best efforts of Mitt Romney and the Republicans to kill it. It is back. It has survived, and it's profitable.
I know.
It's doing well.
It was amazing. That whole process and the whole last campaign was just amazing.
And you were a real champion in that, Senator Stabenow, and we really appreciate that. Tell us about these new clean auto technologies. What is this? Give us a little detail here.
Well, what we want to do is take what the Department of Energy does and what they call advanced vehicle technologies really to the next step and really give them some additional support to double down on hybrid and electric vehicles, for instance, not just for small cars, but there's great work being done on larger vehicles. In fact, in Michigan, we've got battery technology hybrids that are being developed for the big trucks, and you know, and the more you can use alternative technology on big vehicles, you actually save more energy. So there's jobs being created there, and there's more we can do in partnership. So this is a program where you partner with the private sector, with universities on new research and development, and we want them to be looking at everything from the next step on electric vehicles and natural gas, as well as energy storage, infrastructure. You know, right now we've got great electric vehicles on the road. A lot of folks are nervous about getting one because they're not sure if they're going to be able to plug in and charge, you know, at work, or what will it mean at home. And all of those things have easy answers, but we need to get that infrastructure in place so people feel confident, because it's great when you can do a great new Chevy Volt or Ford vehicle or one of our other great vehicles where you can go 300 miles on a gallon of gas because you're predominantly using electric batteries. So there's just a lot of opportunities for us, and it's all jobs. It's all about American jobs.
I think one of the most interesting things about this legislation that you're proposing, Senator, we're talking with Senator Debbie Stabenow, and by the way, her website, Stabenow, stabenow.senate.gov, is that both the Blue-Green Alliance and the UAW, you know, the progressive environmentalists and labor, and the Motor and Equipment Manufacturers Association, a trade association more often associated with, you know, business interests, are all supportive of it.
Yes, and in fact, we've also had the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which I mean, talk about a broad coalition. This is a very broad coalition of folks, and it's because it's about innovation, it's about the future, it's about energy independence. It really is about creating jobs. You know, a major opportunity for us in this country is around new alternative energy jobs, because every time we're talking about these things, somebody has to make it. Somebody has to make the parts. Somebody has to make the battery technology or the infrastructure or the pumps or the vehicles or, all of this involves manufacturing, new advanced manufacturing. And that means good paying middle class jobs, which is what we ought to be focused on.
Yeah, and what Michigan badly needs, and at one time when before the Republicans got control of it, it led the world on. I mean, it's just this.
There's no question. But you know, we're coming back. I have to tell you, I have to brag on Michigan a second. Michigan is now number one in new clean energy patents.
Wow.
So the new ideas are coming from Michigan. So, this is the next, economic revolution for us if we can keep focused on research and technology development in the right areas. And it's one of the things, frankly, that I am most concerned about, what is happening among a whole laundry list of things, of what's happening in Washington and Congress, is that the Republicans have really gone after those efforts that are about our future, things that, that we've already cut that relate to new innovation, technology, research, that folks don't feel yet, but we're going to feel it when we are not prepared for this global competition in terms of new technologies.
Yeah, and we need a 21st century energy grid as well.
Absolutely.
I don't know if I've ever mentioned it to you. I was born in Michigan. I was born in Grand Rapids. I grew up in Lansing. I lived there the first 27 years of my life. My wife, Louise, her father was the Assistant Attorney General for the state of Michigan, worked with Frank Kelly. And
that's so great. I remember you saying that. Yeah,
yeah,
that's so great.
Our roots are in the state, and all of our family is much of our family is still in the state. And it is so great to see Michigan coming back and to see a real warrior for the state of Michigan, for working people across the country, of course, as well. But, in yourself, Debbie Stabenow. And so is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners about other things that you're up to right now?
Well, I'm just trying to make sure that as we go ahead and as we focus on where we go economically and on the budget, that we understand that we have to be pro-economic growth and jobs, that we're never going to get out of debt with more than 11 million people out of work.
Yep.
So we better be focused on jobs, and then as part of that, that we need to focus on making sure that we make smart decisions about government spending, and that includes the tax code.
Mm-hmm.
That includes going after, the special deals for the wealthy and the well-connected. It means going after 100 years of subsidies for the oil companies. They don't have to worry about renewing the production tax credit like the wind folks and solar folks do, every year. They've had it embedded in the tax code for 100 years, and we need to stop spending that doesn't make sense that's in the tax code, those things that are taking incentivizing jobs going overseas and so on. So I'm all about making smart decisions and cutting spending, but we've got to make sure that the spending that's being done in the tax code that only affects the few, the wealthy, the well-connected, is at the top of that list.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think it's crazy that those of us who work for a living pay one tax rate, and people who literally sit on their butts around the pool waiting for the dividend checks to arrive for a living pay half the tax rate. As Ronald Reagan said, that's crazy.
It is crazy, and what we're seeing now in our country, and is of deep concern to me, is the disconnect between what is happening on Wall Street, soaring, and what's happening to working people, middle-class people who are not soaring,
yes,
who are not seeing their wages go up in the same way, who too many people, have still their houses underwater. So, I mean, the real measure here is where we're going. And we are making improvements. It's not that. It's not But we need to be focused on, you know, growing a middle class. That's the difference between our economy and those around the world who want to be like us. They want a middle class. And what we see right now is, you know, the middle class being hit over and over and over again. And too many folks, you know, not sure if they're going to be able to even get in the middle class. So we've got a lot of work to do around the economy and creating opportunity, innovation, education, investing in making things in our country. There is a path forward, but, you know, on the other side, the Republicans really view their job as just protecting the wealthy and the well-connected. And, you know, that has really contributed to where we are at the moment. And that's, we got to change that.
Today is International Women's Day. You're one of the few women in the Senate. I mean, it's certainly not the 50-50 it should be given the population ratio. In the minute we have left, any thoughts on International Women's Day and how we can further empower women throughout the United States and the world?
Well, I would say, Tom, that, you know, we finally at least have hit 20 of 100. That's our first, because of the fact that the Democratic women in the House and the Senate stood strong. We passed the Violence Against Women Act. When we stand together, all of us work together and stand up for what's right. And in this case, it was for the principle that violence is violence. It doesn't matter who you are and where you live. You ought to be protected, the law to protect you. We won that. The president signed it on Thursday. This was a real victory for standing up for the right thing. And we need to be reaching out as role models to help women around the world create more opportunities for themselves and their families.
Absolutely. So well said. Senator Debbie Stabenow, thanks so much for dropping by today.
Good to talk with you.
Great talking with you. Give my best to Michigan.
I will.
Thank you very much. We'll be back. It's Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. It's 45 minutes past the hour, and back with your calls right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And, we had a caller who was a plant. Well, that's going to be an interesting one. Stick around. Trey wants to tell us all about it. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to our executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producer, Shane Farnan, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our phone screener, Danielle Gilday, to our writer, researcher, Sam Saxon, Nate Sweet. Welcome to the team, Nate. To Alva Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum at WYD, everyone at all the various companies that syndicate this program, Dial Global on the commercial side, Pacifica Radio and nonprofits, CRN Network on cable systems, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the other cable providers who carry our program independently, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Networks, and others, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on the big picture. To our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, to Alan Ratner and Victoria Jones and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, our underwriters, and to you for supporting the program. And I can't tell you how much it means when you actually call a radio station, a TV station, an outlet, or an advertiser, or a sponsor, or an underwriter, and say, you know, yes, we listen to, we watch the Tom Hartman program, and it's useful and valuable. I suppose it would mean a lot if you said, get rid of the bum, too. I'm not going to encourage that, but I think, you know, speaking your truth is a good thing, whatever it may be. Trey in Dallas, Texas. Hey, Trey, you wanted to talk about a caller that we had earlier?
Yeah, that fellow from California called in the Mark Thompson show yesterday afternoon when Marcos Malixos was on there, you know, speaking as a guest.
The guy, you know, the caller who said, I'm paying 50% income tax?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty much the same thing, you know, and I love the way you handled it, man. It's just a beautiful thing to hear. You got that guy off the phone?
He dropped off the phone himself, actually. I didn't dump him. I was waiting for him to give me some kind of a rebuttal, and he didn't have one. But my guess is that he's actually, you know, if he was actually making that kind of money, he would be busy working. He wouldn't be calling into talk shows, which is not to say people are called into talk shows are not working, but this guy, if he's calling multiple talk shows, that's probably what he does for a living, and he's probably not making that kind of money. He would probably like to. He's probably being paid 25, 30, 50 bucks a call if he can get himself on the air, and then he submits the the clip of being on the air and, you know, to one of these right-wing foundations, and they pay a bounty for this kind of stuff. There are services, actually, there are services the talk show hosts can hire to have people call in. Mostly they're not political. They're for the morning zoo crew kind of shows, you know, where somebody will call in and tell a weird story, and then they can riff on it and make jokes about it. But there is also this make money in your spare time thing that the right wing funds. I don't know of any left wing versions of it, but, you know, there are right wing funded ones where people call in, or more commonly, they blog. They post things on message boards and blogs, and they get paid per post. So, interesting, Trey. Thanks for the heads up on John. Our software keeps track, you know, remembers our callers, and so it'll be interesting to see what happens if he calls back and you know what he has to say. But on the other hand, I get it that these guys, you know, they call into a lot of shows and they can probably do a lot of damage by spreading lies and misinformation. I don't think they get away with it on our show. And so, Trey, thank you for the call. And thanks for the heads up. I appreciate it. Ken in Geneva, Illinois. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Okay. I like your show, and I learn a lot from it.
Thank you.
I don't know why the Social Security is on the table, because we're paid from the Social Security Trust Fund, and then we have to pay an income tax on the amount that we get.
Right, which is crazy.
And so,
but it was Reagan.
In my case, my wife and I made $10,000 on Social Security, but we had to pay $1,000 back in the income tax.
Yeah.
So why are they trying to get rid of it when that's going into the general fund?
Well, not everybody's making enough on Social Security to pay income taxes, but the reason they're trying to get rid of it is because Pete Peterson has spent several $100 million funding people like Erskine Bowles and what's his name, Simpson. Alan Simpson, isn't it? Yeah, Alan Simpson, and others like them, you know, Cat Food Commission 2.0 or 3.0 over at Fire Dog Lake. Jane Hampshire and her buddies there at FireDogLake.com are doing a great job of promoting this Cat Food Commission meme, and God bless them for it. And you know, these guys, they're Wall Street billionaires, and they want to get their hands on the Social Security money, and it's just that simple. And they've spent enough money and gotten enough talking heads on enough programs, particularly television programs. Particularly network television programs, that they've convinced Americans that there's some problem with Social Security and Medicare, when to the extent that there is a problem, it's a problem that the Republicans themselves created so that they could say, see, there's a problem. Ken, thanks for the call. Daryl in Denville, New Jersey. Hey, Daryl, what's up?
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. Real quick, that caller from California, I heard him on Mark Thompson's show, too, yesterday.
Uh-huh.
He's called Mark Thompson's show probably a half a dozen times over the last year. So
yeah.
I don't know if he's a plant or he's just
he might just be a cranky guy. I mean, you know, I'm guessing Mark Thompson. Mark's a good guy, and he's a great radio talk show host. I'm guessing he kicks his butt, too. But in any case, Daryl, what's going on? You wanted to talk about economic collapse. We have just a minute before the show's over.
There was a couple of callers ago that said that he didn't understand why chain CPI and all these things are on the table and why the president is willing to compromise. And you rightly pointed out that these people are trying to blow up the economy, and the president knows he's going to be blamed for it. And what I would, to those people who wonder why the president isn't as intransigent as they would like him to be or as combative, consider that there are a lot of people who don't necessarily get involved in the minutia of public policy or, you know, listen to talk radio or read left-wing blogs or whatever, who would be harmed if the economy were completely blown up.
Right.
And while those of us like my wife and I, who are, you know, we have a couple of bucks saved, so we can weather the storm, there are a lot of people out there that can't weather the storm. They cannot go 6 months with a blown-up economy and survive. And so we need to keep that in mind and keep those people in mind.
Daryl, you are, Shano tells me, you have won the copy of Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision. I'm going to put you on hold. Daryl's on line 3. You can let Danielle know. And congratulations. Coming up Monday on the Tom Harbin program, all the news and information from the weekend. Plus, we're going to talk Reaganomics with Peter Ferrara, who says, America is becoming the world's leading socialist state. And I'm saying, hey, if it was true, that would be bad because what? And don't forget, democracy begins with you. It's not a spectator sport. You got to get active. Tag, you're it. We'll see you on Monday.
been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.